We get to read about the death of Saul today. Yeah, oh well. Had to happen eventually. Life is a terminal condition. Everybody dies from it. This is 1 Samuel chapter 31. I'll open with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask your blessing upon this study, upon our discussion today, that you will bless it, that we may learn from you, learn from your wisdom, that we may apply it in our lives. We trust and thank you, God, and ask for your presence. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
1 Samuel 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men died together that same day. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled. And the Philistines came and dwelt in them. So it happened the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. Then they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. Now, when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth Shan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days.
Thank you, David. That was 1 Samuel chapter 31. Very short chapter. That's okay. Any questions or comments regarding this chapter? Yes, Ellie.
Why did they put his army in his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths?
Ah. Has a little bit to do with what the Ashtoreth is and what his armor meant. We'll talk about it now. That's okay. It's a legitimate question. Saul was a unique person as far as the Philistines were concerned. In particular, obviously, because he was king. He was also a very, very talented warrior. He wasn't just any ordinary king that sat back and howled generals to the work. He's actually a very skilled killer. Much like David was. One of the reasons why he and Jonathan were all very well trained to killing in battle. One of the reasons commentators, at least, addressed the fact that Saul was hit by an archer as opposed to hand-to-hand combat, because none of the Philistines were willing to approach him. It was too deadly to come too close to him. So they kept their distance. Granted, he had a spear, and noted, as you recall, when he went to attack David, he hurled a pretty good distance at a, quote, elderly man, if you can use that term. He wasn't that old, 50s or so. Pretty good enough, and David only survived by just barely getting out of the way in time. Saul's not someone you mess with, so to speak, on a military battle. So to have killed such a great warrior is very important to the Philistines. To take his armor, of course, which was there, take his armor and dedicate that to their goddess, which the Ashtoreth is their goddess, is that, look, this wonderful warrior to mate with you to produce new Philistine warriors, so to speak. Very common for great warriors to have gone through that process, whether they're Philistine or otherwise. But enemies in particular, because they were the enemies of their goddess or their god, and now you can produce new offspring, please, oh, Ashtoreth person. Yes, David.
I found it odd that they took the bodies and burned them.
Yes, that is a very unique thing. It doesn't happen normally. As you know, in Jewish tradition, to have your body burned is a disgrace. Hence the Holocaust and everything else, and the valley which gets the forgot what it's called. That the never-ending bodies get burned up. It's a disgrace process. You don't normally have that happen. Thank you. That was the word. And typically, you wouldn't only burn a body. Particularly, a king's body wouldn't burn, but it's been debated as to why they needed to burn this particular body. In particular, the primary guess, just a guess, is that because his head was still missing, it wasn't with the rest of the remains, they were not going to bury him completely. So they just burned what they could have. It was probably a decomposed and heavily mutilated body at that moment. Whether they needed to burn it, whether they could have just buried it, that's debatable. I don't have a good answer as to why they would desire to burn him and his three sons' bodies as opposed to just burying them whole. It's just strictly a debate. It is an unusual act. It's not done since, and as far as I know, it hasn't been done prior to this, so it's kind of an odd choice. It may have a little bit to do with who Jabesh-Gilead people were, who the men, who that tribe and that their culture or tradition was at that moment in time. They were on the opposing side of the Jordan, the opposite side of Jordan, and they were also the ancestors of Saul, his sons. So they are family, and it could be their personal family tradition. Yes.
So they didn't find the head. They didn't use it as a...
There's debate as to where the head went in First Chronicles, which is First Chronicles. It records the head being posted or nailed to the Temple of Dagon.
Because I think in Turkey they always did that as a symbol of their superiority and conquest.
A but burning also, or head part?
The head.
The head, oh, okay.
Yeah. That they fastened the bodies to the wall.
Yes.
It reminds me of what some of our troops have experienced in Iraq, where they were mutilated and displayed
for display.
And strung.
It is a very grotesque, barbaric act, as far as I'm concerned. And also, completely against Torah. Of course, these guys don't believe in Torah. It's made a difference to them. But you don't leave a body hanging, in particular overnight. That's not allowed. So it's a rather despicable act, which I think one of the reasons why the men of Jabesh-Gilead desired to get to the body so quickly, to get it before the sun came up, because he would have hung in there all overnight otherwise. Yes, Joshua.
Yeah, I was just going to say... could it also be, because it says they put his armor, you know, in the temple.
Right.
I mean, couldn't it also be like just a trophy of, look, the mighty warrior have fallen, and
that,
you know,
is,
our God has given us this warrior or whatever.
Now, that would normally apply, I would agree with that, if the armor was placed in the Dagon temple, which is a male temple. The Ashtaroth is female, it's the goddess's temple. And the Philistines worship both, the Dagon and his wife, Ashtaroth, pronounce its name. They worship both for two different reasons. Dagon, of course, for prosperity and wonderful bounty and wonderful battles, being very successful at that aspect. Ashtaroth for reproduction, giving freedom, the two different features of it. So as far as the Philistines are concerned, I can see that hey, we are, quote, free from Saul. So here, Ashtaroth, get your, you know, whatever. But giving it to offering it to Dagon would make more sense to my mind. Not to be completely off the wall on that. I could just, whatever, maybe this was the proper solution. I don't really know. I'm not too familiar with the worship of Dagon and Ashtaroth that well. Yes, David.
It just came to me because the next verse says that they took their bones thereafter and buried them.
And buried them.
Usually, they will allow, just like they did during Jesus' time, they would put the body in the cave and allow it to completely decompose. And then when its body is fully decomposed, what's left is the bones, then they would take the bones and bury them.
True.
So maybe in they didn't have a burial place at that point or time, and they hurried the decomposing process up. It's just a thought to hurry up the decomposing, and they still took the bones and, mm-hmm. and honored them by burying their bones.
That's a fair point. That could be. I know that David comes back a few years later, digs them back up, and reburies them back, the bones and the brains, back in Kish's grave, Saul's father, and the family grave. I don't recall what city it's in. I've forgotten. But so David does it again. That's a good point, though. Maybe that was their objective, in order to bury the bones, because to accelerate the process, as opposed to letting it decompose naturally. It may have already been decomposed pretty severely already. Yes.
Is there something in the Torah stating, Yahweh's commands about how to go about the burial process? Or, because I always thought, when you're dead, you're dead. What does it really matter to God where your bones are? You know what I mean?
Like, I haven't looked that up as far as the burial process. I don't think there is something explicit in the Torah. There is things you can't do to a body, but as far as what you're supposed to do to it, I don't believe it's actually recorded down anywhere. It's going to be a cultural tradition at that moment in time. As far as not burning a body, it's strictly Jewish tradition to not do so. The Torah doesn't say you can't burn a body. The Torah only says you will not leave a body hanging overnight. If it's dead or whatever case, you must take it down. Sanitary persons. to get rid of, because whatever body dies, obviously bugs and germs and whatever else are happening, it contaminates water. You bury it quickly, which makes sense for hygiene purposes, yeah. But beyond that, I don't have an answer for you. As far as what you can and can't do. Yeah, dust to dust. Yeah. Which how Judaism gets the point is you cannot bury a body in a sealed container. Because it never returns to dust. It has to go back to the earth, that's part of the Torah. You must return it to the ground. That's a given. But that's pretty much the limit of what we have. Yes, Ellie.
Well, also, that dust to dust acknowledges God gave life, God takes it back. But the decomposition problem would not have been reason, I don't think, for burying it, because they were burned. And the burned was deliberately disrespectful, knowing that he was ahead of Hebrews. But burying it could very well have been to put it somewhere where no honor would be given, because Saul's grave could have been honored. And they would have buried it and just gotten rid of it.
Well, okay, but this
but
the,
David
these
finds
the,
it later. It,
well, these are the acts of Jabesh Gilead. These are ancestors of Saul. These are actually the people. These are part of the Israelite tribes. They are doing this as well. That's the debate while we're discussing. They fasted for 7 days after having Saul and his sons. I mean, 7 days is a long time to fast. Not that they didn't have any water. They probably have water, just no food for 7 days, most likely. So it's not. I don't perceive this as a disrespect issue to Saul, but I could be wrong. Yes, Jeff.
Cleansing the treatment from uncircumcised Philistines.
That's something you point out there. Judaism has this rule that if a righteous man dies, that was a tradition, of course. Righteous man dies, all of his possessions must not be allowed to be obtained or used by an unrighteous person. They must be destroyed. That's blatant cross-the-board rule, no exceptions. So they argue that, well, in that context, it's possible that because of what the Philistines did to the bodies, we don't know what they were, that it was a contamination process of this righteous person. Thus, cleanse it of what the Philistines did by burning off the unrighteousness, and then you have just the bones left. I don't have much beyond that, though, as far as tradition is concerned. Yes?
And I would say cleansing, more purification, because fire is for purification.
It is a purifier. Yes, it is. There are some naysayers who greatly dislike Saul and point this out, that this was not a honor burning. It was rather a dishonor due to the killing of all the priests at Nob. But that's just the debate. Yes, Carrie.
What about the possibility of the Philistines knowing how the Israelites deal with their dead and them coming trying to steal the body back?
Most likely the Philistines did know this because of Samson. They had other experiences with the Israelites and it coming to dead bodies and them coming and taking them away. Not an uncommon event. Most likely the Philistines were fully aware they were going to take the body because of where Beth Shan is. It's right here, as you can see on the little map here. At Mount Gilboa, which is where Saul and his sons and most of Israel died, This is in Jezreel Valley, of course. Bethshan, you notice where it's at. It's still in Israelite territory. It's a city right along the Jezreel Valley. Bethshan means that, a house of ease, house of a simple life. Well, we all like to live that. Right there near the Jordan. Yabesh Gilead is not that far away. All of this region or half of the Jordan pretty much stayed in ownership of Israel, while the other, just this one section, Jezreel Valley, the Philistines owned. They put it in the easiest place that the people of Israel could come take the body. Easiest locations. The shortest travel. You cross the Jordan, you literally cross it within less than half a mile, you're at the city. And you cross back. Well, that's the easiest thing to do. That is a way you can say, well, giving the body back, so to speak, is a concept, knowing that they're going to come to take it anyway. So the Philistines may have had that in mind when they did it to start with, but it's hard to say. Yes, Jeff.
That's quite an incursion from Philistia all the way up there to see if Knesset.
Yeah, the Philistines took control of, it's estimated, somewhere around 30% of all of Israel, this one incursion, which is a massive undertaking. They did not touch the southern half, as far as where the tribe of Judah was. They didn't go into Benjamin's territory. They're pretty much all the northern tribes from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, Naphtali, Asher, chunks of most of Dan. They took all of that, and it's theirs. Not the log, of course, but it's theirs. I want to point out as to how they were able to do this so easily. I use the term easily. Some could argue differently, but this is how I consider it easily. Bethshan, who owned that town? Not that you can remember this because I had to look it up. I forgot. Let's go to Joshua. Oh, my other button here. This is Joshua. See, it's first. Well, actually, Judges records it almost identical to Joshua. So we'll read Joshua's instead. Joshua chapter 17. Verses 11 through 13. There's a number of cities listed here. This happens to be one of them. In Issachar and Asher, Manasseh had been given Beth-shan and its towns, Eblim and its towns, the inhabitants of Dor and its towns, the inhabitants of Endor, and its towns, the inhabitants of Tanakh, and its towns, the inhabitants of Megiddo, and its towns, three hilly regions. Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities. But the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it happened when the children of Israel grew strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. Yeah. Do you recall when Saul went to the medium in Endor? Was that an Israelite city? No, Canaanite. Bethshan, is that an Israelite city? No, Canaanite. Megiddo, where this battle started, was that an Israelite city? No, Canaanite. Still Canaanite. So how was it that the Philistines were able to incur so deeply? Well, who were they actually fighting? A large number of the cities wanted them there. A large number, not all, but a good chunk of them. That's all it takes. When the populace desires you to relieve us from these Israelite people, it's a lot easier to incur and get assistance for an army to travel up that deep. I mean, Philistines had a lot of help. No, these cities remained Canaanite control for quite a long time. Eventually, Israelite pushed most of them out. But as God said, because you did not push out the Canaanites, they remain a thorn in your side. And here's a very good-sized thorn. Philistines had assistance, is another way of wording it. The whole region was populated, pockmarked with Canaanite cities and peoples who didn't like the Israelites. They were being forced labor and forced tribute to them and had remained doing so all the way through Saul's reign for 400 years nearly. It's a long time. So that's the reason why the Philistines were so successful, other than the fact that God, you know, obviously had a huge hand in this. So that's a major factor that's going on here. Any other questions or comments? All right. You know, this is a relatively short chapter, not a whole lot to talk about, but there's a few things I want to point out to you. Note, Saul's sons, how many died? Three. How many sons did he have? Four. Yeah, the youngest son is still alive. I always mispronounce this guy's name. I feel really sad for Mephibosheth. No, that's a different word. Ishbosheth is made king. Yes, thank you for pronouncing that correctly. I am a terrible mispronouncer of this guy's name. I feel bad for him. But, you know, oh well. Ishbosheth is made king. He is the fourth son of Saul. So, question. If three of Saul's sons and Saul dying at Mount Gilboa, where is the fourth son? Not there. Clearly he didn't go to either to that portion of the battle, or maybe he wasn't there at all. We're not quite sure what was going on. It appears that Ishbosheth, because of 2 Samuel, I think chapter 3, I think it is, when he has to talk to Abner and they have a disagreement and Abner out yells him, is a cowardice or a young man, most likely a young man. Probably below the age of 20, thus unable to go to battle. Note that David at this time is somewhere approaching the age of 30, and Jonathan, Saul's oldest son, is about the same age as David. So the fourth son of Saul could easily be younger than 20. Not a dead giveaway, but easily. If he is younger than 20, he's not to be in battle. The other question I have here, actually point I want to point out here, is that if he was in battle, there is a good probability he was with Abner. Abner is Saul's, or was Saul's, main general. He was in charge of all the Israelite armies and getting together to do various things and coordinating them to in battle and directing them. Abner does not die here. He's still alive. He doesn't die with Saul and Saul's men and the rest of Saul, though he was Saul's personal general and bodyguard. He's not here. Where is he? Makes you wonder. I think we'll read a little bit as far as what might be happening with Abner. So, if Ishbosheth is there, he is most likely with Abner. If Ishbosheth is not there, either way, Abner doesn't die here. He lives to fight another day, though all the rest of Israel left and fled. I wouldn't be surprised if Abner is the one who called them and said, hey, turn tail and run. As a general, you're going to see when you're totally outnumbered and you're dying. It's your job as a general to get your men out of there as quickly as possible. So he may have given the order to flee, knowing that there was no way they could survive. And all of Israel, because they're in the Jezreel Valley, would have traveled straight down the valley all the way through across the Jordan to safety. The few that would have lived. Abner was most likely directing them to get them fleeing in an orderly fashion. the least a number of them would die. Though leaving Saul and his sons and whoever been with them behind to, quote, hold back the Philistine forces long enough to get the men out. I'm giving him a lot of credit. I don't know for sure if that's the case. He may have just fled too, but hard to say. But we'll discuss a little more about him. So, the fourth son of Saul is not there. And it says in verse 3, now, your verses may word it differently than mine does, so this is not a make-or-break deal. Mine says, read this correctly here, so battle wore down heavily against Saul. The archers, the men with bows, found him, and Saul was terrified of the archers. And Saul said to his armor-bearer, draw your sword and stab me with it. At least these uncircumcised people come and stab me and make sport of me. Armor-bearer did not consent, for he was very frightened. So Saul took the sword himself and fell upon it. Mine does not record Saul being struck. Did you catch that? You notice that? It didn't say Saul was struck. Read that one more time. The battle bore heavily against Saul. The archers, the men with bows, found him, and Saul was terrified of the archers. And Saul said to his arm bearer, draw your sword and stab me. Has to do with some Hebrew words. They can be translated a lot of different funny ways. You know, when you go to from one language, from ancient Hebrew language, which is unused, to then going into a couple of languages before it finally reaches English, you have some funny words, a lot of mixing going on. The term found is the proper term, found. The archers found him. But one could technically argue finding could imply hitting. Right, exactly. Like an arrow finding a target. One could argue that. Thus, they said, oh, well, if you found him, Saul wouldn't be afraid of just being, oh, look, I've been found. Quick, start running. Nothing like, oh, I look like I was hiding. That would make very little sense. So, because of Saul being such a great warrior, it would make more sense he must have been hit by an archer, as opposed to being found by an archer. Right or wrong, I won't tell you that. But, yeah. Just note that there's a difference in that particular Hebrew word. Yes, Joshua.
My version here says, the fighting went hard against Shaul, then the archers overtook and wounded him so that he was in agony.
Right. So that's the other word of this. Note, because mine says, they found him and Saul was terrified, the archers. The terrified word, which mine turns terrified, is what you're referring to, wounded in agony. Both same Hebrew word, translated, both are correct.
Amalekite ends up saying that he was leaning against his spear.
Malachite doesn't record the archer. He just talks about leaning against the spear. Malachite doesn't talk the archer. That particular person. Right. Yes, David. Run, Jeff.
Kind of like the flip side, like that bumper sticker says, you know, like they found him. Well, it's like, I miss my ex-wife, but my aim's getting better.
Yeah. That's pretty bad. Okay. So let's go back to this terrified or wounded in great agony. The term in great agony or great pain is correct. The term terrified here is also correct because you can be terrified in pain in both directions. The actual Hebrew word means in pain and spun around and danced. Spun around in, as dancing, as if you were dancing. That's what the word, doing it in pain. It's a bizarre thing. What doesn't make any sense? Well, if you're standing up and you were struck by an arrow in an intense amount of velocity, guess what happens? You spin around. I've been struck. Now, you can buy either direction. You won't argue whether he was necessarily struck. I believe he actually was. My personal opinion, I think he was struck by an arrow. But it means to be spun around in great pain, as if to dance in great pain.
If you think about it this way, you first get struck on the right side, then you get struck on the left side. You start looking kind of spastic. It hurts.
Yes, because of who Saul is and his capabilities in battle, I'm inclined to believe he was actually struck by an archer. That's my inclination. But I just point out the Hebrew words are so funny here because you're dealing with ancient Hebrew words that mean things differently than what they have been translated as. It would probably make a whole lot more sense had we lived, 2,000 years ago, but or 3,000 years ago. But it's a little odd today. Most likely he was struck by an archer, and he probably was in great pain. But the impact most likely spun him around of some form, potentially. They're trying to describe the method by which he was struck, the appearance. What I find most fascinating is who watched it. But he's dead. He didn't say, oh, quick, write it down. Okay, now I'm going to kill myself. Malachi comes up much later. Before his son watched it. That could be. It's Holland. Yes.
The only difference, though, between maybe Saul and maybe any other general you can imagine that would have been, in that position of being shot up by arrows, whether it's Jonathan or any of the other people there.
Right.
Unlike Jonathan, Saul knew what was happening, knew why.
Yes.
That would terrify me.
Yeah.
In a way that your normal, typical general, king, whatever, would not necessarily feel.
No, God was the one who was doing this, and there was no way out.
Yeah.
Which makes me believe that Saul would have made sure Ishbosheth was not there, knowing full well that he and his sons were already dead that day and the kingdom turned over. Not knowing the outcome of Abner, necessarily, but he would have known at least the outcome of his sons. Most likely, of course, he was struck in fear. As I mentioned before, the Philistines didn't come up and fight him in hand-to-hand combat. Again, tradition, because he was such a difficult person to defeat in that fashion. So, just a side point. The armor bearer does not consent to thrusting Saul through. Why not? He's being ordered by the king to do this. But if you respect the king, why would you not obey his order? But the armbearer is going to kill himself anyway, so what does he care, right?
Him to kill the king.
Kill the anointed. You know, it's something that David was very big on. You don't kill the anointed of God. You allow God to kill the anointed of God, but you don't allow yourself to kill the anointed of God. If you do so, far be it from you to be fallen into God's hands. I believe the armor-bearer, being Israelite as well, would have had the same fear and revere for that position and what God put that particular king in. Hey, this was an anointed person by God. Samuel is the one who anointed him. He's very skilled at what he's doing. Right or wrong in all of Saul's past, the second issue, the armor-bearer would have been focused on the issue that this is the king, the anointed of God. I will not kill you. He's just not going to do it. Now, is this armor-bearer, is he a young man? Is he just, you know, too nervous, too scared? Well, I think, because this is Jewish tradition, says he was just a young boy. You can't be a young boy, you have to be 20 years or older. No young boys allowed. There's a rules here. Keep in mind, who was Jonathan's armor-bearer? Now, his name's not listed. Back when Jonathan had an armor-bearer, he went up with the Philistine garrison, the two of them took out 20 Philistines. These are men which you spar with. These are sparring partners. You practice your battling techniques with one another, and you refine them. So this armor-bearer of Saul's, he's probably very good, or at least good enough, to be Saul's sparring partner. If Saul is such a great warrior, which he's supposed to be, the armor-bearer most likely was also. I don't believe the armor-bearer was too afraid in the fact of, oh, well, you know, I'm just too young, or just I've killed somebody, so to speak. That's not the case. Most likely, armor-bearer was actually very skilled at what he did. But he most likely, in my mind, revered the king and the position.
Yeah, I was going to say, I totally agree. It would have been someone worthy of being an armor-bearer for him. And then at the disgrace of, you know, who he was supposed to protect dying, him so disgraced because you're supposed to lay your life down for it. And that's the whole purpose of armor. You know, fell on his own sword.
Yep.
A coward wouldn't fall on his own sword.
Would flee a coward in front of him.
Exactly.
I didn't do it or whatever. Trying to lie to get his way out of the issue. that's my personal opinion. So this question was brought up a number of months ago, actually. 2 Samuel records Saul not quite dead yet when the Amalekite shows up. Well, this scripture states the armor-bearer waited until he died before he threw himself on his own sword to die. Which one was right? Now, we discussed at the time, well, maybe one was lying. Who knows? Here's the deal. The wording here is, in fact, Saul was dead, then the armor-bearer thrust his sword. And is the correct translation. Saul was dead. Not Saul was dying, rather Saul was dead. Here's the issue. Who wrote it down? Did the armor-bearer write down, I waited until Saul was dead, oop, punctuation, then I thrust myself through with my sword? Ah, but were there witnesses that said Saul was dead before, or what? Here's the deal. Because there were no normal witnesses, as you use the terminology, you could deduce, by the way, this event by just seeing the picture of Saul and the armor-bearer. You could figure, okay, obviously one's leaning on his own sword, and you could have figured out what was happening. But, so there didn't have to be necessarily a direct eyewitness that said this is what happened. But my point is that the armor-bearer doesn't have to necessarily wait until Saul is, quote, dead. He sees, all right, Saul, you are dying, and he perceives you're dead. He's going to kill himself, too. There's no point. Yeah, no, there's no point. So, whether or not the armor-bearer waited or not waited, no one has any record thereof. Most likely, well, actually, I won't say most likely. I won't tell you which one's most likely, because either that or the Amalekite's lying. What does it matter? It really doesn't matter. Either way, they're all still dead. So, whether or not Saul was dead, for fact, before the armor-bearer threw himself off, or was still dying, no one has that written down, per se, because no one was actually there and said, Saul, are you dead? And checked his pulse. Okay, armor-bearer, now you can thrust yourself through. Only the Philistines would be there. the archers, they're all fleeing. All the Israelites are running with their lives, trying to defend themselves before they all die. Because no one survived Mount Gilboa, by the way. No one survived on Mount Gilboa. No Israelite survived.
It matters that it be written in truth for when that man is resurrected, and he knows he waited until his master was dead before he killed himself. And what he possibly did was he killed himself on top of his master's body.
Possible. It's not recorded. That's possible. And I'm not faulting the armor bearer by any stretch of the imagination. Quite the opposite. I have no issues with the armor bearer at all. If I was in his shoes and I had the courage to do so, I probably would have done the same. I'm cowardice by nature, so I probably wouldn't. I'd probably run and flee, and I'd probably dress up as a Philistine. And say, hey, you know, I'm not you. I'm and trying to get out. That's my own personal nature because I'm a coward. But I don't believe he was a cowardice. Yes, Phil.
For some people, that they might use that for a way to clear themselves for killing their own self in today's
way to society. Clear themselves. Wait. Say that again.
They might use this as a way of saying, well, he killed himself, I can do it too.
Ah.
Without any judgment.
Yeah, I believe there's a rule about that. Let's see here. Did I write that rule down? I think I may have. Let's double check. Genesis chapter 9. I think there's a rule about committing suicide, if I recall correctly. Chapter 9, verse 5. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast I will require it. And from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds a man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly the earth and multiply in it. This command sent unto Noah. The covenant. That committing yourself to suicide, killing yourself, God will require your life for doing that for you, to you. God will kill you for killing yourself, is another way of wording it. In dying, you will die. It's not an honorable thing to do. Now, I won't say that Saul's necessarily... Wait a minute. Saul will probably be dying and die for a lot of reasons. Don't get me wrong. He did a lot of things that deserve like a permanent, everlasting, all eternity, you know, burn and rot in hell kind of thing, death, for all the things he did wrong. But in dying, you will die is the concept behind this. By killing yourself, God still has not killed you for killing or striking another man. He'll have to kill you later. Not a desirable thing to fall in the hands of the living God. Same principle. You don't kill somebody without just cause. Now, having said that, this Saul is considered given a pass for this. Meaning that Judaism treats him as a, hey, this was a justified suicide. Because Saul was completely correct in his assessment of the situation. That the Philistines would be mutilating his body beyond recognition and doing really weird, disgusting things with it. And he was correct. He said, this is a disgrace to God to dishonor God in this fashion. So Judaism gives Saul a pass for committing suicide. You know what? I don't really care. It doesn't matter whether he did or didn't get it passed, because Saul probably has other issues to answer to God for, not the least of which is the medium and various other things he did. The armor bearer, personally, I don't know. Killing oneself is a difficult thing to deal with. I won't argue that you should or shouldn't kill yourself. It's just an interesting issue, an interesting way in which God has worded things in the past regarding this. Yes.
I remember David saying, and when he was given the opportunity to...
strike Saul.
No, in Psalms where we read, where he chooses to fall into the hands of God, armor bearer probably would rather fall into the hands of God than into the hands of man, because if he had not killed himself, he may have been accused of killing Saul.
Very could have been, because it was Saul's own... sword and spear, and our bearer's job is to hold on to those things, so Barry could have argued that way. That's interesting, because David does that a couple of times. He rattles off, it's better to fall in the hands of the God, because God has mercy, versus the hands of man, who has no mercy. So, based on that, and David does point out, at least twice that I'm recalling, he used that reasoning, that argument, that I'm inclined to believe whatever with the armor bearer, whatever happened with Saul, God's mercy is enough to, hey, I understand what your emotions were, because I created you. I created those emotions. I understand what you were thinking. I understand what you were feeling. I understand what you're going through. And if God will choose to give mercy or not give mercy, that's his behalf. I have a hard time faulting the armor bearer for what he did. I have a hard time faulting Saul for what he did. I just do. Because if I was in that situation, I understand what they're going through. I jokingly say I'm a cowardice, but reality, I probably would have done the similar effect. I am not that much of a coward, so to speak. Yes,
yeah, that brings up an interesting point, because on that topic, you know, in 70 AD or right around there when Jerusalem was sacked,
yep.
I thought there was a bunch of people that went to Masada or were living up there, and
yep.
they saw the Romans coming, and they actually killed their...
They all killed
families and then themselves.
Yeah,
or
well, two people were still alive when they got up there, and they were dying in the process. So, yeah, I believe it was two.
They began to kill their own people.
Yeah.
Came up.
Yeah, yeah. They were killed. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, the people, the Israelites are the ones who had to build the ramp, and they were, when they figured it out, that they said, oh, we're killing our own Israelite citizens by trying to throw rocks at them. Let's just kill ourselves and call it good.
You wonder how God feels about
it. Okay, what God was thinking at that time, I don't know. I do trust that, you know, as Kathy pointed out, God is very merciful. And he understands what's going on and understands why people do certain things. And I would, my personal gut would say, he will likely discuss it with those individuals at the time. And because he is merciful, may grant them mercy on that issue. Yes, Ellie.
There's a difference between laying your life down for someone or to save someone and killing yourself in a selfish situation. In the New Testament, you've got when a person is abusing someone and cannot stop, better to have an anvil thrown around your ankle and you throw and you fall, you get thrown, you jump, whatever, to take yourself out for the protection of someone else. Military do it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You lay down your life for someone else. That's a different situation.
No, I agree with that. I'm going to move on beyond this. Apologize, I have to finish this chapter, and I'm already out of time, as usual. Okay. I'll point this out anyway, because I think it's very fascinating imagery. Verse 6. So all of Saul's men with him died there on Gilboa, of course. I mentioned it before, not Abner. But I want to point out to something. A few chapters ago, in chapter 26, is it? Yes, chapter 26. When David sneaks into the camp of Saul and all of his men, Saul's men are all sleeping around the camp, and he has his nephew with him. And so discussing about, you know, taking the spear and thrusting it through Saul. Where's Abner? He's asleep next to Saul. So imagine this imagery for a moment. David is standing while all of Solomon's men are down. David's left alive, so to speak. I'm using that terminology. I'm using a similarity between the concept of a deep sleep from God as also being death. I'm using that same terminology. So David remains while all the rest of them are down. So the image of almost like a foreshadowing of the concept of what's going to be happening. But when David takes the spear, he leaves. He yells out and says, Abner. He accuses Abner. You did not protect the king. You deserve death for that. I think David was prophesying. Whether he knew or not. And he's prophesying to Abner. Abner, you didn't protect the king. Because he didn't. Abner, whether he was assigned to do whatever by Saul, who cares? His primary task was to protect the king. And he ends up telling Saul's son, my job is to protect your father's household. And he felt really horrible about the fact that Saul was dead and Abner he wasn't by Saul's side. So I think Abner realized this is an unacceptable scenario, that Abner lived and the king and his sons didn't. I think David foreshadowed that or prophesied that almost in the context of saying, Abner, you I accuse for not protecting the king. And of course, it results in the future that that's exactly what happens. Abner does not protect the king. Whether you die in the service or not, if you don't do the service, it doesn't do you any good. I find that an interesting little point. I wanted to point that out. David and Abner don't have enmity for very long. They actually are pretty good associates. Yes, they are opposite sides of a war between both houses, but they respect one another. And they always remain that respect. So 1 Chronicles records that Saul's gear was put, he was given to Ashtaroth, his head was given to Dagon, and his body was pegged in Beth-shan. Three different parts. Oops. Keep hitting that thing. I want to point, the reason I think that they put his head in Dagon's temple is the same reason, is the counterbalance. You recall when the Ark of the Covenant was taken from Israel and brought into the Philistine territory and placed in front of the Dagon's statue. What happened? Fell over. Once. The second time, what broke? The head broke off.
And the
arms broke off. His body was dismembered. His strength and his head. Hence the armor and the head of Saul and the body. Yeah, they sanctify. It was a really weird, odd, they did some odd things to that. But I my personal opinion, I think it's a great contrast. The Philistines, I think, understood your God crushed our God, but see, our God now crushed you. It's a way of getting back. Because no, they said, rattle off at all the temples. Look what happened. Look what happened. Our gods have been justified. They have sought the revenge and got it. Just a interesting point. Yabesh-Gilead. Who are Yabesh-Gilead? I mentioned before, these are the men who came. They left Yabesh-Gilead, and they went up to Beth-shan, grabbed Saul's body, the remnants of it, and of course, his sons, and brought him back down, of course, buried him, burned him, and everything else. Who are these men? So they were the ancestors of Saul. Recall back when Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, did something really horrible. Isn't it? Was similar to Sodom and Gomorrah. And all the tribes came forward. They all said, let's go to battle. And they all went to battle. And except one. One city didn't go to battle. Yabesh-Gilead did not go to battle. Would not go up with the men of Israel to battle Benjamin. What was their punishment? Their virgins were kidnapped. All the women that were available were taken from this people, of course, because all the men of Israel swore we would never give our daughters to Benjamin. And then when they killed up all the females, there are only males left. There are only males. Guess what happens after a generation goes by? There's nothing left. It's gone. So all the daughters were gone. And of course, all the males left. Yabesh-Gilead. They didn't go up. They took the women from Yabesh-Gilead, said, here, have them. This is about 300 years, 200 and something years, or before, almost 300 years, before Saul's death. This happened. Keep Benjamin's tribe alive. Very important. But then, when Saul became king, actually before he became king, something bad happened to the people of Yabesh-Gilead. Ammon, Nahash, the snake, came up and conquered most of the territory and told Yabesh-Gilead, give up or die. They said, can we just give up? He said, you know what, I'd rather just die. I'd rather have you die instead. 7 days go by. He seizes the city, or he surrounds the city. They get word out, they send it to Saul. This is before Saul, after he's anointed, but before he's set king over Israel. They send word to Saul, said, help us, help us. Saul gets all of whatever he has with him. Goes up, wipes out, and completely trashes Ammon, the king, and everything they have with him, saving the citizens of Yabesh-Gilead, his ancestors. To my personal opinion, I think they were returned the favor. You saved us about 3 years earlier, 4 years earlier, something like that. It's probably about 10 years earlier. It's our turn to repay the favor. We'll get what we have. We will cross over into the Philistine-owned territory. We'll return and grab your body and return it back to where it belongs. Back home. Makes sense. At least to me. One last comment. 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 13 and 14. This first chapter 10 records almost the exact same verbatim for the first Samuel 31. Nothing really different about it, except the reasons. Which I find is interesting that they chose to do that. Not the right or wrong, just that's what they did. So Saul died. This is chapter 10, sorry, verse 13. For his unfaithfulness which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore, he, referring to the Lord, killed him, and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. Is that an accurate assessment? Sorta. You see, the people who record things aren't necessarily the people who actually live through them. Keep that in mind. Historians are not actually the ones who are alive at the time. They're the ones who record stuff based on the history that they have available to them. Saul was not killed for consulting the medium. That was not the reason given. That's not the reason that God gave him. Not the reason Samuel gave him. Not the reason that the entity that Saul talked to gave him. The reason he was being killed is for disobeying God. Period. And not killing the Amalekites, and not waiting for Samuel when he was supposed to. For two reasons. Saul was God was going to rip the kingdom out of your hand and give it to your neighbor who is greater than you. Those reasons given. Whether or not it was the consultation of the medium is a factor, is not listed by the people who lived it. Not listed by Samuel, not listed by David, not listed by anybody that. Which is added up later. Well, he also did something really, really horrible, according to the person who wrote this down. You're right, he did a lot of things that were really, really horrible. And this one probably added to it. Whether this was the reason, I would argue, no, it is not the reason. God chose his reasons, and he already had it set up. But it also points out, but referring to the Saul, he did not inquire of the Lord before he killed him. That's not true. Saul inquired of the Lord many, many times. God didn't answer him for a variety of reasons. It's not that Saul didn't inquire. God didn't answer. Now, God didn't answer for a lot of good reasons. A lot of things that Saul had no business asking God anymore, because Saul didn't listen to God the last time God talked to him. Thus, God quit, essentially gave up, quit. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I guess then you could ask, was he really inquiring?
Oh, sorry, say it again, I didn't catch
that. Was he really inquiring?
Really inquiring.
If he wasn't listening, and he wasn't asking for direction up to that point, he wasn't really inquiring.
It's possible. What I would ask or question, if that was the case, is that the priests that Saul talked to and asked through by using them to talk to God, and God wasn't answering them, of course, as a result, thus not answering Saul, it would imply that if Saul wasn't inquiring, then the priest wasn't inquiring either. To me, that's how I look at it. That if I ask it for assistance, and assistance doesn't do it either, that means neither one of us are, quote, good enough for God to answer us. And because of that, how I view it, and I could be wrong on that, how I view it, that would imply that the priest time was also unworthy of receiving God's guidance. The high priest, of course, was a pretty honorable person. He was also a descendant of a person that Saul killed. Yes.
Does what he did and what others have done in the Bible, is that the final judgment? You know, the physical judgment that came upon him for, you know, he died, physically died. Is that also indicative of his spiritual death?
Yeah. Spiritual death?
Or he never says if he was repentant or not necessarily,
right.
But so you just don't know where his heart was, but it's hard to, you know, what do you think?
You're asking my personal opinion. I can give it. It doesn't mean I'm right. Just personal opinion. In most cases, I don't believe most things are final. I really don't. Because God is a merciful God, he has the ability to undo whatever he chose to do in the past. And Saul did do things that were actually good also. He wasn't completely horribly disgusting from the ground up all the way through. He wasn't the case. He did try. He did believe in God. He did actually trust God. He was a little confused when God was talking to him, when God wasn't, but that was his confusion. I have a hard time saying this is his final judgment. Like, he will never be, going up and, seeing God's face again. He'll be, he's just toasted his history. Granted, many could argue he would be because of all the things he did, murdering a whole town with priests and high priests is not something, God's priest is not something which you do. To me, that's a really horrible thing to do. It's something which not very many people would be forgiven for, I would think, because a high priest is such an important role and function of how you take care of all of God's people. To murder them based on your personal opinion or personal thoughts at the time, and as opposed to actually giving them a trial, is a rather despicable thing to do. But whether or not that's enough justification for God to say, I will not see your face again, I can't answer that for sure. If I was in God's shoes, I might do one thing that was completely unacceptable to God. So I won't go there.
A lot of the characters, not necessarily in books of the prophets, but a lot, certainly in the Torah, a lot of characters are playing a part in a scenario that's allegorical of other things.
Yes.
And some of that allegory still does come over into the prophets. If you're playing a part, and you happen to be playing the part of the bad guy in an allegory, you got a bit of a problem, because he's put you to play that part. So for him to consign you to permanent disposal because you played the part, it's not usually like how God is.
I could see that, and I would like to get that. I will talk about that next time I'm up here, because I have to go review of 1 Samuel before I go into 2 Samuel. But also in mind, Hitler played a part too. And that's something which we don't like to think about, but that was a role that God needed to have someone play. He just liked it really well and did a really good job with it. There are a lot of people that that play a bad part, but if you do too good of a job and you like it too much, guess what? Not good for you. Yeah, exactly. So there are consequences to that too. I'm going to end in the comments or questions. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.